Well, the mystery religions thrived from the late 3rd century B.C. into about the 6th century C.E. So for about 800 years. In fact, the greatest competitor to Christianity in the 5th and 6th centuries were Mithra and Asclepius. Even though Christianity had become the official religion of the Roman Empire, there still were there was a lot of mystery religion activity into the early Middle Ages.
Interesting about Luther, his 1-1 relationship with God, the emphasis on individual relationship, also created big problems politically because he blew apart the Holy Roman Empire with that idea. Yeah, he had not only changed all of Western thinking, or was a turning
That's
point,
right.
but he also did politically
That's
incredible
right.
changes with that.
That's right.
And that broke open nationalism.
Yeah. That's right.
And
That's right.
that could be said to have broken open colonization as well.
Exactly. Absolutely. I mean, these things are not unrelated. Our theology is not separate from our economics and our politics. As much as we would like to have some neat, clearly defined two-kingdom theory, it doesn't work in practice because our theology ends up being the foundation upon which the Newt Gingrich built. I mean, that's a scary thought, that somehow our theologies are a part of this. See, I don't think the problem is Newt Gingrich. I said this on Monday. The problem really is systemic. And Gingrich is just the front for it now. Gingrich, Phil Gramm, all the others, Bob Doyle, Bill Clinton, he's a part of it too because he's no different from the others. It's a systemic problem that somehow we're going to have to get a handle on. And the systemic part of it gets underscored by this cultural affection for individualism and temporality and eventually steamrolls anybody who doesn't buy it. Steamrolls anybody who adheres to a spatial and community-based orientation. Let me give you some examples of Indian communitarianness.
I just wanted to comment and argue, frankly, that I think that it was Calvin, really, who codified the individualist approach to me and God, that Luther sort of had his feet in both camps. He was still a good Roman Catholic. He never rejected that. He was dubbed an individualist because he reinterpreted the Catholic dogma. But it was John Calvin, a century later, who really kind of got the me and God, the work ethic. You will not work, you will not eat. The Protestant, if you will, the Protestant work ethic and all that baggage that comes with that individual and God comes out of Calvinist theology in terms of the way we practice it as Luther. I'm arguing as a Luther enthusiast that in fact Luther is not really the seed of that. It's really Calvin
was
brought
inspired
that.
By Luther. I mean, Luther probably didn't elaborate on it, but I think Calvin, what did precede Calvin? Calvin was certainly, on some level, and if not a disciple, influenced heavily by Luther.
No, he wasn't at all a disciple.
But he was influenced, certainly. I don't think the issue is blaming Luther or anything like that.
Right,
you're just finding the origin of something.
Right. In fact, Luther isn't the origin of Western individualism. Luther takes what's in der Luft, it's in the air, and does something with it that is dramatically new. It's also very powerful. I mean, the doctrine of justification by faith, for me, is the most important part of my Lutheran heritage. I'm not ready to say, let's get rid of that doctrine, because I think it is so powerful. But I think it's also problematic in that inherently it does codify a growing sense of the this proportionate importance of the individual over against the community. Calvin, in fact, still clings to a theological notion of community to, in ways that Lutherans didn't. His notion of the sovereignty of God in relationship with a community of people rather than just the individual is clinging to a bit of that past communitarianness that eventually, I think, erodes in the modern structure of denominational volunteerism entirely. So I'm not just bad-mouthing Luther, and don't want to do that. I'm just trying to show that there's a cultural trajectory that runs through European history that eventually results in the mess that we're in now, in terms of rampant individualism and the violence on Denver streets, and I assume it's not much different in Seattle or Minneapolis or other places you live. I spent last fall in New York teaching at Union, and I know it ain't different in New York. The rampant individualism and the lack of community. New York was terrible for that. I was lucky. I lived on campus at Union, so that I had a built-in community of people that knew who I was and took me in and made me a part of them. But as I walked up the street past Columbia and Bernard and on down Broadway towards Times Square, it was amazing how many people there are, all moving so fast, all going somewhere. I never knew where they were going or why they were walking so fast. And none of them having anything to do with the others. I learned very quickly in New York, not to look at people, not even to look at their feet, just to focus on something else so that there was no eye contact. And I just picked it up from others. That's the way they treated me. I decided to be safe. I better not look at them either, because in New York, you can never tell what might happen. That to me is a symbol of the downside, one of the symbols of the downside of this individualism.
One thing I'm a little unclear about, because you got multivariables going here.
Absolutely.
But is your thesis then, if you had 8 million Indians in the same place, that you wouldn't have fundamentally the same kinds of issues?
I guess what I'm trying to get at is,
I think in the small rural communities that I grew up in, there's a much different, much more communitarian feel than,
No doubt.
What I think of as sort of the apotheosis of Western culture. So I wondered what the significant variable is.
What I'm saying is, in Carl had it right that you would, in given Indian cultures, spatiality and communitarianness, you'd never develop a setting of 8 million Indian people. That would be unthinkable, because true communities, and it's never clear cut. I mean, it's not just black and white. I can tell you about small communities. One of the things here is that Indian people are related to land. Land is terribly important. People want to know where you're from.
Well, they I can tell you babies as soon as they attain a certain size.
Oh yes. Yeah, there are lots of stories in different tribes about how that was done. Birth control was definitely practiced by Indian people. I can tell you about communities in Norway or Denmark where the same family has lived on the same farm for over 1,000 years. That comes close to what I'm talking about in terms of Indian spatiality. But something strange happens when a family on that farm has three children. And one of them inherits the farm, and the other two go to the University at Oslo. And those who go to the University of Oslo, at Oslo are converted to temporality that fast. They have to in order to study at the university. Yes, sir.
Getting kind of back to individualism, when you brought up the idea of, I guess that Luther kind of started where it's just kind of me and God, it's my faith that matters.
Yes.
I think that's also pretty plain to see in the way that many Americans relate to their country, the government. It's kind of me, my family, and the country. I'm loyal to the country. I'm not loyal to anyone around me.
Yes. Yeah.
They come on my land, I'm going to shoot them.
Yeah.
But I'll fight.
That's interesting. That's interesting.
Yeah, it really is.
I think it's very similar. If I can give some examples of communitarianness in the textbooks, in the anthropologies, you read about one Plains Indian ceremony. And it's interesting, this ceremony is called the Vision Quest. Anthropologists write invariably as if this ceremony is no longer practiced. I mean, I've read books about the Vision Quest in which the author seems never to have talked to a real Indian. And anthropology is now text work. You don't go talk to Indian people, but you read earlier texts, and they become the primary source documents, and you write your dissertation on the basis of some late 19th or early 20th century texts about the Vision Quest. But one of the old saws that you still read today in articles written in 1995 is that the Vision Quest is a quintessential example of Plains Indian individualism. And they say that because one person makes this rite of vigil. One person leaves the community, goes up on a hill, and spends typically 4 days with no food and no water in a small area, all 8 to 10 feet square. That seems like individual, right? Individualism. And the person will stay there for 4 days, hoping for a vision of some kind, perhaps. Although I know people who have done this 20 or 30 summers, praying each time that they will not get a vision. Because when you get a vision, it's not empowerment. It's pure responsibility, because you have to live your vision. So they make the rite of vigil in order to keep themselves spiritually whole. But they hope against hope that they will not get a vision. It's a ceremony I've made myself 10 summers. And we'll make it again later this summer. It seems like it's individualist, but what the ingredient that's missing in all the anthropologies is that the individual never makes the rite of vigil alone. In fact, in the Osage way, I've got to find a shoka and ask this person to be my shoka, my messenger, my helper, my guide. And not only that, but I've got to deal with a medicine man or a medicine person, and my shoka will be the go-between between me and the medicine person, so that the ceremony begins in the village. It's not an individualist ceremony, but it's the community ceremony. And when finally a group of people, I never go off, rarely, go off by myself to make the rite of vigil, but a group of people will take the person who's going to make the rite of vigil and walk with them up the hill taking them typically out of an earlier ceremony. They would probably go through purification first in what's called a sweat lodge. Take them out of the sweat lodge. Typically, when I've done it, once you enter the sweat lodge, you do not speak. You do not communicate with human beings. So in silence, everyone else can talk, you can't talk. They take you out of the lodge and up on the mountain somewhere and put you in a place, and they'll draw a line around you, usually with tobacco ties. And I'm there for 4 days and four nights, not able to leave that place for all that time. No food, no water. And those people will sing a song before they leave me. And they've left me, and they will not come back until the fourth day. But the whole time, they're going to be in the ceremony house down the hill praying for me. They won't even open a bottle of cold pop without thinking about me. And they've already told me, we're going to drink lots of cold pop while you're up there. You just remember, we're drinking cold pop. But they won't open their pop without remembering that I'm suffering. At the end of 3 days, you don't sing anymore because your tongue is stuck to the roof of your mouth. And you're completely dehydrated. But they're down there praying for me, and even remembering as they go through their day-to-day activities, because they know why I'm making this rite of vigil. They know that my prayer is not for me, not for my family even. I am constrained against praying for my own family when I make the rite of vigil. Or only as a last resort would I pray for my family. But they know I'm praying for them. That's why I am doing this. That's why I'm engaging in this ceremony of suffering and sacrifice. When people dance the sun dance, the saying is, that the people might live, so that every sun dancer dances that the people might live, not for one's self-empowerment, but always for the community, so that these ceremonies are always community ceremonies. That's very different from New Age, because when the New Age people come out into the Indian world, what they want is personal self-empowerment. Individual self-empowerment. I would say that New Age is Western individualism run amok. And that's not to put people down. It's to analyze it and say, this is what it is. Obviously, they're folk who have found spirituality in its Euro-American context to be totally unsatisfying. Totally unhappy, unfulfilling. And they're looking for something else. What I'm saying is, because culture is these millions of habitual responses to the world, that they can't help but move into this world, bringing their culture with them and interpreting discrete Indian pieces of culture in terms of their own culture, and in the process, it gets violated and isn't the same thing. Let me give you an example. In Living Waters, a couple of years ago, a young man came to church, and we get a lot of white visitors at our church, and a lot of times, if people are mixed blood, you can't always tell if they're Indian or white. So I asked this young man if he was Indian. We were just making conversation over coffee afterwards. And he said to me, no, he said, I'm just a white boy who carries a pipe. Now, pipe carrier is a technical designation for someone who carries a pipe for a group of people, for a community. In my tribe, every family has a pipe. Every male has a pipe. Many of the females would have a pipe. But there'd be a clan pipe. The Eagle Clan would have a clan pipe that maybe one person's being called upon to keep for the clan, to bring out for those ceremonies when the clan pipe is needed. So when this young man said, I'm just a white boy who carries a pipe, you know, sometimes I speak without thinking. It just came out. I said, oh, who do you carry the pipe for? The guy looked distraught. It never occurred to him that anybody would ever ask him that. What do you mean? He said, who do I carry the pipe for? I said, well, a pipe carrier carries the pipe for a community. Who asked you and empowered you to carry or gave you the responsibility of carrying a pipe for them? Well, Wallace Black Elk just gave me a pipe. He sold it to me. He said, I'm a pipe carrier now. Well, see, there's an Indian entrepreneur who's also figured out the system. But there's a critical difference here between those two cultural systems, which means that they don't translate. You know, languages are not merely codes for each other, right? How many of you speak another language besides English? A couple of you, right? Well, languages are not codes for one another. So that, you know, if you have language A and you're working in language B, you can look up the code in language B for something in language A, and there it is. It doesn't work that way. I mean, it's a matter of not just translating the words, but translating whole metaphors. I mean, I'll give you one example that I think a terrible metaphor to teach kids in America in 1995. And yet we do it in all our churches. It's this thing Jesus called the kingdom of God. A perfectly good metaphor 2,000 years ago in Palestine, but a miserable metaphor in 20th century United States. Do you realize that when we teach our children that Jesus taught about the kingdom of God, that we're telling our kids that before they can understand the gospel, they've got to know what a king is? Isn't that ridiculous? I mean, it made perfect sense in Jesus' day because there are kings and queens aplenty. But here we are telling kids you can't understand the gospel without knowing what a political system is that is very different from ours. What I would say is, in order to translate the Greek basileia tou theou, we've got to translate the metaphor, not just the words. We've got to come up with a metaphor that grabs kids and tells them, this is what it is. It's really important. It's the most important thing, something they can live with, something out of their own experience. I don't know what it is.
But washed in the blood of the Lamb. I mean, it's a terrible thing to say, kids.
There's another one. Yeah.
Washed in the blood of the Lamb. No, if that's not, that's just gross. Kids have no concept of that.
It's getting even worse with bloodborne pathogens these days.
Well, in Geneva at a World Council meeting, we were discussing. I'd raised this issue, and Betty Bettenhausen, who's very fond of Boston, you know, she taught at BU for a while and is still in the Boston area. Good Lutheran. Feminist theologian. Betty suggested that we call it the Commonwealth of God. Yeah, right. The only state that's not a state, it's a commonwealth. The Commonwealth of God. But, you know, it fits. Except that everyone around the table from former British colonies stood up and said, no! And so a fellow from India suggested the People's Republic of God.
Why didn't you care for the Kingdom of God?
Because it's not spatial. It is relational.
It's relational.
It picks up on the relational part of it. But it's not yet spatial. It's got to be both spatial and relational for me. Because it's got to be a place. It's got to be, for me, all of this is God's basileia. All of it is. God created it. So not just all of you are God's basileia, but all those people like Newt Gingrich and George Bush, who don't even know they're part of God's basileia, think they have their own basileia, are still a part of God's basileia. And they're in for a surprise one of these days. But especially, you know, the trees, the deer, the mountains, the river here are God's basileia. So it's got to be a place.
Can that be included in kingdom? I mean, I don't say that it can.
Possibly.
As a kin, I mean, possibly. I think of that.
Possibly, but then you have to interpret it that way. Mm-hmm. And in this world, it doesn't, especially here, it doesn't quite interpret that way. Because what I want to do is say that it's got to be interrelational to the extent that my relationships have to be not just with two legs, but with all of the created realm, with the four legs, the wingeds, and the living moon. So that when, the super mitaki or mitakoya or yasin, all my relations captures it, because mitakoya or yasin means, all of my relatives, including the rocks that people think are inanimate.
Just take that one letter, kingdom of God.
Yeah, that's right.
It's an oxymoron, democracy of God.
Except that God doesn't stand for re-election every 4 years. See, we talked about that one too. The realm of God? I use the realm of God. Interestingly enough, biblical scholars in the last 100 years have almost invariably said no to the word realm because it was spatial. Because they want the kingdom of God, the basileia of God. And I use the non-sexist basileia instead of the English kingdom usually. Because they wanted it to be temporal. They wanted the basileia of God to be an answer to the question when. And realm raises the where question, which in fact is my question and why I like the word. So that the whole debate around the basileia of God and biblical scholarship has been around the word eschatology in terms of, and even eschatology loses its focus when you start talking about end time eschatology or realized eschatology or actualized eschatology or imminent eschatology. All that jargon, it's all temporal though. It all answers the question, when will the basileia come? And Indian people are looking out the window saying, well, isn't this it? And the question isn't, when will it happen? The question is, when, oh when, oh when, will you recognize it?
I don't mean to push you too far from your thesis, or one of your theses, but is there any downside to communitarian? And when I'm thinking historically, I know that if you were outside the community as an Indian people, depending upon your people, to be outside was not... for instance, that many tribes make war upon each other, not a war of extinction, or very
right,
rarely,
right.
But there were raids, because yes, these people were not, like for instance, the name of the, I don't know whether it's the Cheyenne or Lakota, their name is the people, and people who are not members of the tribe were not the people, in that sense. Now, my assumption then is the only downside to communitarianism is how large the community.
Well, the community is symbolized in the circle, but it's as it were concentric circles, so that ultimately the community is Well, it starts with my family, meaning extended family, which is intra-tribal but inter-clan, because my family will be in different clans. Or the circle may be the clan, or it may be the tribe or the village. Osage has had 5 permanent villages throughout Missouri. Or it might be expanded at some point to include all Osage-speaking peoples, namely Kaws, Poncas, Missourias, Otos, Iowas, but they really pulled out and hooked up with Sac and Fox and even changed their language. But ultimately, it might even be inclusive of Lakotas and Dakotas, who are Osagian-speaking peoples as well, even though the dialect is very different. And in fact, there are clans at both Pine Ridge and at Rosebud that are Osage clans. They call themselves Wajaja, which is one of the Osage division names. Ultimately, it's going to include 2-leggeds, 4-leggeds, wingeds, and living, moving things. Ultimately, in the Lakota phrase, Metakuya Oyasin, it's all things are related. So that when Osages go to war, or when we hunt, it's no different when we hunt. Going to war, the war ceremony and the hunt ceremony before we went out on a buffalo hunt were essentially the same ceremony. We know that the sacred is going to be violated, necessarily. We can't eat without violating the sacred. Hence, we must have a ceremony to justify what we're doing. So the ceremony will consecrate the lives who are those who are going to be killed. It may be enemy lives, maybe our own. Even in the hunt, we may lose hunters because buffalo hunting is a dangerous activity, with or without horses. But certainly, we'll consecrate the lives of the buffalo that we're going to kill, so that there has to be some reciprocity in order to keep the community intact, because the well-being of this community depends upon the well-being of the larger community that includes 2-leggeds, 4-leggeds, wingeds, and living, moving things. All of creation, ultimately, Christians would say. The well-being of my community depends upon my knowing what prayer to say before I pick the corn that I planted, because that corn has its own life, and I am violating the sacred by picking the corn. I'm violating the sacred by picking cedar to burn in a cedar ceremony to enhance my prayers. So I have to know which prayer to say before I can pick cedar. And I'll even take tobacco. And maybe part of my prayer is offering tobacco back to the earth or to the cedar nation, that mystical entity that this cedar is a part of, before I take a branch of cedar to harvest the leaves, the needles for a prayer ceremony.
Do you integrate these ceremonies with your Christianity? I mean, do you see it as a part of your Christianity?
I do, yeah. As the Indian people have always, just taken things in. Mm-hmm. And the real surprise to Indians was when they took Christianity in, then they were told, well, you have to let all this stuff go. But at Living Waters, we don't let it go.
So
we do both.
Yeah,
we do both.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. So that there really isn't a downside to community until something enters the world of community that makes community dysfunctional. Actually, what I'd like to say is that this notion of community is a very powerful notion for keeping the world in balance. because it's always give and take. You don't take anything without giving. There's no possibility of this group clear-cutting a forest, for instance. There's no ceremony for clear-cutting a forest. And we would know that if we clear-cut the forest, that we would have violated, we'd have stepped too far. We'd have violated the sacred in ways that can't be balanced anymore. Charlotte Black Elk told me one time, I've never seen it documented, because anthropologists and white historians aren't interested in this, so I'm the only one that's documented, and I footnote Charlotte for having told me this, that she's Lakota, the granddaughter of Nick Black Elk, that in fact, whenever Lakotas moved their camp, they would plant where their camp had been. They plant willows in every tent site and a cottonwood in the middle of the camp where the campfire had been. And they plant those because, they grow so easily in South Dakota. If there's a little water, they're gone. They're taking over. So they reclaimed the earth even where they had their camp. Well, if Osages go to war, the ceremony for going to war is ultimately 11 days. We can't go to war. We can engage in self-defense, but we can't go to war without completing this 11-day ceremony. And the first step in that, to again emphasize that the vision quest is not Osage individualism, the first step in the community deciding to go to war is the little old ones, the Nahonjinga, will pick a kaheka. And if you're picked as kaheka, you make a 6-day rite of vigil. So the first day we pick the kaheka, the next 6 days, the kaheka is out in the wilderness on a hill, fasting, making this rite of vigil. Then when he comes back into the community, the Nahonjinga finally declare whether we're going to make this war or not. And a 4-day ceremonial ensues that involves the whole tribe. Then after 11 days, finally the warriors can leave camp and go hunt down the Pawnees who have violated Osage territory, who have come in too close, you know, there being a large territory that's shared. But if they get too close to the heartland, it's like the Midianites coming into the Valley of Asharon, right? You know, they have come into Israelite territory in the story of Gideon, in the book of Judges. Then you've got to do something. Well, the Pawnees have transgressed, having made an incursion into our heartland territory. We better go out and make sure they understand that we're still here. See, if we become weak and smaller, then we can't defend that territory. And we've got to pull back. And they're allowed to take it. I mean, the borders aren't fixed. While spatiality is important, there are no temporally fixed borders, artificially forever and ever, from Evikat to Evikat, changeable only upon a new war that is going to carve off part of Poland and a part of Germany and make it Poland, part of Poland and make it Germany, as things were. Well, once we find those Pawnees, they may be on that bank of the Neosho River, and we're on this side. So we're going to sit there. Scream epithets at one another in sign language. There are 30,000, a vocabulary of 30,000 words in Plains Indian sign language, universal from Texas into Canada. And in no uncertain terms, we're going to tell those Pawnees. They're not going to take it lying down because they're going to signal us right back that we better stay out of their way or they're going to count coup on us. So this may go on all day until finally the Pawnees back off, back down and leave. Doing a single arrow fire. And the war's over. We had an 11-day ceremony to stand on the bank of the Neosho River and insult the Pawnees and have them insult us. Makes sense to me. or if they're not ready to back down, they're going to test us. We may have a fight. But in that fight, first of all, the war honor doesn't go to the person who kills an enemy. It goes to the person who first, for instance, touches the dead body. And another war honor will go to the person who manages to touch a living enemy without being injured yourself or touched yourself. Of course, there are no rules on how gently you touch the enemy. rather ugly implements of war that were used as coup sticks. Just a short stick with a huge rock tied onto the end of it to touch my enemy with. So, but still, it's touching the enemy, not hurting the enemy, that gets me the war honor. So this battle may go on, again, all day, a fierce battle, until blood's drawn. And once blood is drawn, the two sides will part. And there's no need to determine who won and who lost. You don't keep track of that stuff. Like remembering that Vietnam is only the second war that the United States ever lost. They lost the Red Cloud War, the Powder River War, by treaty in 1868, Fort Laramie. But people conveniently forget that they lost that war. Pretty soon we'll forget that we lost the Vietnam War, too. And we'll once again be unbeaten in the International League standings.
Of redemptive violence.
New season.
We're getting primed for the World Series, right? Except there's no Soviet Union to go up against. It's not any fun anymore. So we only have Iraq. No, nobody's worried about who won the war. The point is that the Pawnees have discovered the Osages are ready to do battle for this territory. And the Pawnees will withdraw. If we're making an incursion into their territory, same thing. We withdraw. And if they have become so weak they can't do battle, then we've extended our territory because we've become stronger and they've become weaker. These things are constantly in flux depending upon the needs of communities. Osages and other Indians didn't know about war making to annihilate an enemy until after the Europeans came. That's when we learned about that kind of war making. So that essentially, what this kind of war making is a part of is a part of a greater scheme of things that ensures the balance and harmony of all who live there, including our community and the other communities. We may call ourselves the people. You know, we don't. We call ourselves the little ones, or the children of the living of the middle waters. But the fact that the Cheyennes call themselves, by the way, not the people, but the real people. that didn't mean they didn't recognize the relatedness of other tribes. In fact, they see not only the relatedness of other tribes, but of the animals and the birds and the hills and rivers and trees and rocks as well. The important thing about community that I think can be said now is that, how are we doing here? Oh, we've almost used up the entire 2 hours. I should have stopped talking a long time ago. But the important thing about community is that these communities are self-determining, self-sufficient, autonomous, involve everyone in the decision-making process. There's no hierarchy that imposes upon us how we're going to do business. It seems to me that there is something to be learned there in the liberation of white America, because I want to suggest in this culture of violence, y'all don't live in communities that are self-determining. The closest Americans come to that would be in small towns, which are disappearing. In smaller communities. But I'll tell you, I live in Denver, and I don't live in a community of respect or a community of concern at all. I lived for a long time on a corner in a house, surrounded by other houses in a pretty nice neighborhood, a middle-class neighborhood. And if my house had burned down, I could have counted on soup 2 or 3 days from a couple of those neighbors, and that's it. Most of my neighbors, I never even knew. I knew enough to wave and say hi, but I never knew them. I live in an apartment complex now, same thing. I don't know these people. Furthermore, I don't want to know them, because if I get to know them, it's going to take me away from the people that I want to pay attention to in my congregation or in my seminary, where there's another community of people that I'm concerned for. But none of those neighborhoods are self-determining or self-sufficient. And there are no decisions made by the city of Denver that I have significant say in. I, in fact, probably have more say than most of you in your communities, because at least I'm on first-name basis with the mayor. Well, we don't like each other, but we're on first-name basis. There's no possibility of being autonomous and in control of your own destiny as a community of people in a modern American city. We live in a context where, estrangement and violence are just an everyday part of the diet.
Well, my question is that in a nation of 250 million and a country in a world of 5 billion, if you can't change that, how can you return to, would you sort of advocate the return to small, self-sufficient communities on a land that can't support that anymore? Or, I guess I'm asking, where are you going from here?
Well, let me say as much about it as I can, and then promise that if some of you are here tomorrow, that we'll continue the conversation tomorrow. But in essence, I want to say that we've got to begin to reimagine a world that takes care of 5 billion people and gives 5 billion people, each one of them, some sense of empowerment in the world. Not a sense of individual empowerment, but a sense of individual significance and community of empowerment. Somehow we've got to make some changes in this world of temporality and individualism that can begin to allow for real self-empowerment. Because see, what I'm saying here is that in spite of this individualism, what we're living in is a world that disempowers everybody. Ultimately, it disempowers everybody. It's just that the poor and the oppressed feel it more immediately. That's why we have gangs in cities, is that we've got teenagers, black and brown and yellow and red, who feel that their only means of empowerment is self-empowerment through the perpetration of violence and the dealing in drugs. How can we... But I'm saying white Americans in the suburbs aren't really in any better shape. policy is determined for us by some national organization called the U.S. Congress or the presidency, and really we don't have any say in that. Representative government is really that. We elect someone. Well, I've been in some communities where they've elected people to the House of Representatives because the guy who's there has already made his millions, and it's time for somebody else to make theirs. You know, it's like tribal government. We have the same sort of democracy imposed upon us by virtue of the Indian Reorganization Act of 1934. And something weird happens when we elect people to our tribal council. Just overnight, the strangest thing happens. We elected them, and they're no longer accountable to us, but they're accountable to some Bureau of Indian Affairs in Washington, D.C. And they're spending more time on a plane to Washington than they are here talking to the people about who we are, what we need, and how we're going to take care of ourselves. They're too busy kissing Washington's ring so that federal programs to the reservation don't get cut back. And in the meantime, they've been strangely empowered. Their families start doing well financially, they start doing well financially, and the rest of us on the reservation are wondering, what's going on here? We elected a reform candidate, a perfectly good person, one of us. Suddenly, he or she's not one of us anymore. How do we change that so that we really are self-empowering, self-sufficient, self-sustaining communities? I don't know. I'm planting seeds. I don't have an answer. I'm planting seeds. I'm just saying it's been done before. It can be done again. I've got to believe that, in fact, we can once again experience God's Basileia in our midst. Luke 17:17. I've got to believe that. That's my faith. That Jesus was serious about this Basileia stuff, and that we can experience it. I think we're out of time.
Well, thank you.
Good discussion. Good feedback. I really enjoy the give and take.